Hey, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow after a day of football in Week 15. Not going to attach the typical hyperbolic adjectives to describe that day because it really wasn't the most exciting day of the season. Just 40 touchdowns, that is the fewest on a Sunday with at least 10 games since 1994, 27 years. At least we do finally have a team in the playoffs, a team in the playoffs, one officially, the Packers becoming the first team to clinch a spot in either conference, so 13 more spots to go. Packers also took over sole possession of first place in the NFC with their win over the Ravens, the only team with 11 wins in the league thanks to the Arizona and Tampa Bay losses, which we'll get to. As for the AFC, we've got a new team at the top there, the team we thought would be there at the start of the season, the Kansas City Chiefs, who are weirdly there because they're playing great defense of all things. We are completely in the upside down, and we only need to look at the week's fantasy results for more evidence of that. You guys, the number one scoring quarterback, rostered in less than 5% of ESPN leagues, Tyler Huntley, with 35 fantasy points. And I've got lots more to say about him coming up. The number one scoring running back, Duke freaking Johnson, who is rostered in, wait for it, 0.6% of ESPN leagues. Less than 1% of ESPN leagues even have him rostered, which is not to say started, just rostered. My husband texted me during the games, Duke on my bench with 31. And I was like, how do you even have Duke on your bench? That's not even a call. Like, oh, I should have known. No, you shouldn't have known. You shouldn't have even had him on your bench. He'd scored 1.8 points on the season before yesterday. He'd only played in one game. His picture on ESPN has him in a different team's jersey, Houston. It's not even updated. This came out of nowhere. The question was, do I play Gaskin in his return from COVID in a great matchup? Or whether Malcolm Brown potentially coming off IR would limit his volume, or maybe Ahmed, but not Duke. Duke was like option number four. Or so we thought, because he clearly wasn't option number four. With 22 rush attempts, that's third most on the week, behind Jonathan Taylor and Craig Reynolds, of course, who's rostered in 7% of leagues, which is kind of my point, right? It was that kind of week. Though I will say Craig Reynolds looked good. And there's something kind of fun about guys coming out of nowhere and balling out. Just less fun for those of us who have worked the waiver wire all season and tried really hard to get to the fantasy football playoffs. And then once there, boom, weirdest week ever. But oh well, that is a different conversation. I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to the conversation I'm about to have with today's guest from The Athletic, host of The Athletic Football Show podcast. You also know him from stints at The Ringer and Grantland and the MMQB. He is an awesome writer and podcaster, and I am excited to welcome him to the show. So let's go ahead and break the huddle with Robert Mays.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-1, 2-1, 2. Ready? Three.
So, Robert, it's thank you so much for making time on this holiday week. I know everything's super, super busy. And, you know, our present came early with like the grossest week of games that we possibly could have to discuss. But good news, I've looked ahead to week 16 and it's much, much, much better. So there's a light at the end of this tunnel.
The weather is gross, so the games might as well be gross. We've gotten into that time of year where I'm wearing a coat everywhere. Everything is gray. The football being bad, it's just one more drop in the bucket.
Wah, wah. There was one highlight yesterday for me as I watched. Well, I mean, there were a few highlights. Okay. It wasn't all bad, but, and I know that you are engaged to be married. And, I'm wondering if you proposed on a scoreboard at a football game and if you were present when that proposal happened, because did you see this story out of the Dolphins game yesterday?
I absolutely did. What could possibly compel you to leave your seat if you knew it was happening at halftime? I mean, the bathroom must have been calling in a real way, or you needed some nachos. Like, you have to stay in your seat that entire time. I cannot even imagine.
This guy at this Dolphins game apparently had arranged for a scoreboard proposal. And I don't know if he just wasn't told when it was going to happen. If it was like, hey, at some point today, it's going to pop up on the scoreboard. Just be ready. Stay frosty. And so at halftime, this picture pops up on the scoreboard and it's a picture of the two of them. Her name is Christine. It says, Christine, will you marry me? Then they cut to the live shot of the two people in their seats. Only it's only one person in the seat because he has left. So it's the girl who just got proposed to by the scoreboard without her future fiance, because apparently she did in fact say yes. We find out later. She's sitting there with her hand over her mouth all by herself. Like, this is a nightmare. And I will say this, Robert, the journalist in me would have left my seat in the press box and run down to that seat. And I would have found out immediately, where were you? What happened? Did she say yes? This trumps what I need to know about the Jets Dolphins for the rest of the game. Like, no one did this. This information is not available anywhere.
That is why I know I got a decent journalism education at the University of Missouri, is because my professor, boss, whatever you'd call him there, I would have been berated if I had not left my seat in that moment. Like, berated. Yeah, I would have heard about it so much after I got back. That's exactly what I would have done. And as someone who recently did this, and how much time and just emotional energy I spent wondering, am I going to do it right? How is it going to be perfect? Is it going to be what she wants? To have it go awry like that in that moment, I feel for him. It's funny, but I feel so bad for him, because I'm sure he went to all this effort and all the calls he made and how nervous he probably felt. And for it to go down like this, it's sad. I hope that they're doing okay and that they're having a better day today than they did yesterday.
Do you think that they had to, he probably had to pay money, right? To get it up.
I don't know
on
how that works.
Screen?
You'd probably have to pay some money. I don't know how expensive it is. My stepdad proposed to my mom on a scoreboard.
No!
Yeah, at the Cubs or the White Sox game. I can't remember which one it was. But this happens. I have not asked him if he had to pay anything, but he did. It was her second marriage.
Put that journalism degree to use, okay? Because now we need this information. You have access to someone who has it.
I should learn. I have not asked about a lot of the particulars. I was just very happy for them in the moment. Just let it sit for that reason.
So the good news, follow up again, they cut back to them later. The two of them were at their seats. She did have the ring on, so we assume that it was a yes. But again, no actual journalism took place in terms of finding out any more information about that. So someone get on that, okay? Someone, I mean, it could be me. Like, I could reach out to people, but I'm like, feel like that's not my job. Like, somebody else get on that.
There's somebody that could do it much faster and in a much more convenient way than you probably could right now.
So probably. So it's a sad Sunday when that's one of the highlights of the day, though I guess on any Sunday slate, that would probably still have been one of the highlights. I figured that this was going to be kind of a gross day of games once I started looking at the teams that were playing each other, and you're going through it and you're like, oh my, whoa, that's not good either. Huh? I'm not looking forward to that one. And all of the expected point totals were very low. Not as low as like 9-0, you know, like we weren't expecting that necessarily in the primetime slate. Can you believe we didn't see an offensive touchdown in that game? People watched it for 3 hours, no offensive scoring.
Last night we talked about on our show, it's hard to get shut out in the NFL. It's difficult to do that. I mean, we've seen some of them this year just because we have some truly terrible offenses in the league this year. The rookie quarterbacks lend to that. But the Bucs had the best offense in football coming into that game, even with no Godwin and Evans. You'd think they'd stumble into a touchdown or stumble into a little bit better of a performance than that, and still not. I mean, it for whatever reason, the Saints really have their number. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's really staggering how much worse he is against New Orleans than he is against every other defense in the league over the last 2 years.
The last time he was shut out was 2006. I heard a stat that was there were no active defensive players were on a roster the last time that Tom Brady was shut out by the way, the Nick Saban led Dolphin squad.
Well, you think about that team that they had in 2006, the receivers he had were so bad that it inspired Bill Belichick to go out and trade for Randy Moss and sign Wes Welker the next year. That's the legacy, the lasting legacy of the 2006 Patriots, is that it was such an untenable situation. Like, never again. We are never doing this again.
I will tell you, there's part of me that kind of enjoyed the concept of Tom Brady playing with nothing around him. Like, oh, this is how everyone else has to play. You know, like, this is Sam Darnold's life prior to this year. Like, welcome to this conversation. Don't look so good, do you?
I mean, that's what he had to deal with at the end of his time in New England. So we've had a little bit of an example of it recently. But yeah, I mean, it's, and that, you compound that with a team that just for whatever reason has figured out how to play against the Bucks. I don't know if it's a formula that people can copy, but the Saints just for whatever reason have totally tapped into it.
The Saints, by the way, I think are, so the conversations about coach of the year at this point of the season, people start to think about obviously all of the postseason awards and MVP and whatever. The Saints are an interesting team to me because they are in the mix and they have absolutely no business being in the mix for a postseason berth. Like you look at that roster and the people who they're trotting out to play the game on a week-to-week basis. And you're like, so I operate in the fantasy football space for a good part of the week. And I'm like, there's just nobody there. I mean, you can maybe play Deontay Harris because he's going to get peppered with targets because, again, there's nobody there. We all know Marquez Callaway at the beginning of the year, people were excited about because he had like one good preseason game and that hasn't really panned out. There's just, I mean, they have Alvin Kamara and then they didn't have Alvin Kamara for a stretch of time, but you look at this roster and you're like, they are, you know, Trevor Siemian and Taysom Hill. And the fact that they are even in the mix right now tells me you have to include Sean Payton in the coach of the year conversation. And I'm not sure that he'll get it because I'm not sure that they will ultimately be good enough as a team to be in that mix. But do you have a favorite for that particular postseason honor?
You're going to kick it around today. So I've been thinking about it and just the options. I feel like Bill Belichick has to be in the conversation. I mean, you look at it, their team is good, but they don't have superstars. I mean, their team is just built of really, really good players everywhere, but he constructed the team. And I know that gets a little bit murky with coach of the year and GM and all of that stuff, but the job he's done over last offseason into this season, I think is hard to argue with. We should probably start talking about how ridiculous of a coach Matt LaFleur is. I understand that he has Aaron Rodgers, but all they do is win 13 or 14 games a year. And their offense is just in such a great spot. So I feel like he at least deserves mention. But I think Belichick right now probably has the inside track in my mind. The other person I would say is Frank Reich, because for them to be a top 10 offense for the third time in 4 years with a different quarterback, and they're just sitting here again with another chance to make the playoffs. They look dangerous. Just those guys, I feel like him and LaFleur, I don't think are being talked about enough in that way. But I do think it's Belichick's to lose at this point.
The Colts beat the Patriots with the worst performance by a quarterback that we've seen this year. Like according to PFF, it was the worst graded quarterback performance of the year. How in the world do you beat that particular team with that particular position playing that poorly? It really is a testament to a lot of things. A lot of people are going to give that credit to Jonathan Taylor and put him in the MVP conversation. I know that there are going to be a lot of people who have a really hard time voting for him because he's a running back. Are you one of those people?
Yeah, I am. I just think that the fact that it's called the most valuable player is difficult to me because the way the game currently works, a quarterback is always going to be the most valuable player. I almost wish, and I've lobbied for this for years, I wish there was a Heisman of the NFL where you gave an award to the most outstanding player in the league.
Just take valuable out of it.
Yes. It's just the most outstanding player in relation to his peers at his position. And I think it'd be a fascinating discussion every single year. For the last 3 or 4 years, I think it's probably been Aaron Donald. And if you went back and kind of retconned, it's like, all right, who would win every single year? What would the conversation look like? I just think it'd be a really fun thing to drop into the mix every year. Maybe we're too far down the road now, but it's just an interesting idea to me. Todd Gurley and the way he was playing a few years ago, that's when I really started thinking about it. It's like, shouldn't we reward Todd Gurley in some way for what he's doing? I know there's an offensive player of the year, but it just seems like there's something else there that we could talk about.
It's like a wins above replacement, like whole, you could get into all of this minutia and at this position, he is that much better than his peers. Travis Kelce, somebody that we could have had that conversation about last year. And
Trent Williams this year. I mean, I think there are a lot of different options. It would be a great conversation starter.
Yeah. I know you love the O-line.
It's hard not to appreciate what he's doing. And again, like, what is he going to win? Nothing. He's going to be first team all pro and that's great. But it just feels like we should look at, I don't know if it's too granular to give out one at each position. Maybe that's too much, but I just feel like one player that is the best at hit, no matter what, you are the best player in the league. You are the most outstanding player. You could even call it that. I just feel like it'd be great fodder. It'd be great for us to be able to have one more thing to argue about. Like, why wouldn't we introduce this?
That would be fun. And then that's a more fun conversation too. Like who is better? So you take the best guy at their positions and then you can get into all the minutia about like how much better they are, how much of a difference they make for their team. And you're right. The word valuable really skews it. Who is going to win that award this year though? Because it feels like now we have a strong recency bias situation that happens, but I was hearing conversations last night that were like, well, Brady probably excluded himself from that conversation. Brady had like a massive lead in the MVP race going into last night's game. So I don't know if you could even say that because who are you going to replace him with? Rodgers, who had that game in week one and really has only come on and played like an MVP in the last like month or so, or like who else could it even possibly be if you're not going to give it to a running back? It can't be Kyler. Can't be like who would it be?
I think you could make an argument for Rodgers right now. I mean, if you look at the numbers, I mean, he leads the league in EPA per play among quarterbacks. If you look at it since week one, the graph doesn't even make sense. He's like so far ahead of everyone else. And I know if you throw out the worst game for everyone, what would it look like? But overall, he's still number one. And the way that he's playing, that game he had against Baltimore yesterday is insane. I mean, he had four or five throws in that game that just make you sit there and shake your head. And for how well they're playing and how the games they're winning, typically when you look at it, I remember Bill Barnwell, when we were at Grantland together 10 years ago, wherever it was, wrote about the qualities needed to win the MVP. And you typically need a first round bye when there were two. You need to have certain statistical markers that you hit. And it feels like if the Packers get the number one seed in the NFC, we have a direct example of what they look like without him. The things start to pile up in his favor. The fact that it's a narrative award and it's been kind of a strange year for Aaron Rodgers is something else to take into account.
Yeah. Will people vote for him?
That's another part of this. I mean, I don't know. But right now, the way he's playing, I absolutely think you could make an argument for him being the MVP of the league and the best player in the league in this exact moment.
So Aaron Rodgers, for all the points that you just made, I find myself wondering about Matt LaFleur. So you said that, you know, he's somebody that you have to give consideration to in the coach of the year conversation. I don't know how much credit to give Matt LaFleur because he has Aaron Rodgers out there. And I know how much he's covering up from a deficiency standpoint. Like, I don't know. Matt LaFleur could be out there making all sorts of mistakes and Aaron Rodgers is going to cover up those mistakes for him. So I just don't know. I mean, other people obviously do know. You watch the tape, I think, more than I do. How much do you think has to do with what Matt LaFleur is bringing to the table?
It's impossible to extricate those things from each other. It's impossible. It'll always be impossible. When you look back at the way we talk about legacies and how entangled they always are.
Oh my God, are we in a new Belichick-Brady conversation?
Well, you talk about that, but even I think it's even more direct with offensive coaches and their quarterbacks, right? Sean Payton and Drew Brees will be the best example for me forever.
Yeah.
How much credit do you give one or the other? When I watch the Packers, to me, the final product they're putting on the field right now is what happens when you put the best quarterback in football in a very well-designed offense. Because that's the coolest part about what they're doing is that you have these moments where Rodgers' kind of singular greatness and his ability to control the game takes over. I thought the Rams game was a perfect example of that, where he's just getting rid of the ball so quickly and the way that he can attack you in the quick game. And they had so many backup offensive linemen in that game against that front and it didn't destroy them. His ability to just kind of have his thumb on the game is remarkable. And I think that's, to me, the perfect example. Last night, I mean, it's ball placement. I mean, some of the throws he's making over the middle of the field, that has nothing to do with scheme, but they also have schemed up shots in that offense. They also have such creative things to do in the red zone that have nothing to do with him. So to me, it's what happens when you have a very well-constructed offense with the best quarterback. And it's really hard to kind of delegate responsibility and talk about who deserves credit in those moments. But I feel like Matt LaFleur deserves more than we're giving him, even with the Rodgers component factored in.
Is Kyler Murray completely out of this top quarterback mix conversation at this point, based on what we've seen for the last couple of weeks? I mean, the MVP thing, I always thought when he missed that stretch of games, like you can't give him the MVP because he just didn't play enough of the season in order to earn that, even though it's a weird season and there aren't people like just jumping up and taking that award for themselves. But I think what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a little bit concerning. Concerning maybe a bit of a strong word, but
if you look at the history of the award, I want to say that Steve McNair missed two or three games the year that he won it, but it's very rare. You don't often see it where a guy can win the MVP after missing more than a game or two. In order to do that, I feel like you'd have to be so far and away the guy. You'd have to have all the narrative juice behind you. You'd have to really finish strong. And I just don't think he's going to be able to put enough distance between himself and everyone else when you take that into account. Like, it's not only being the best guy in terms of rate stats, it's the body of work. Where you did you provide the most value to your team over the course of the season? And if you miss three or four games, it's really difficult to do that. So I feel like this little tiny dip that he's taken, even last this week, might be enough to derail it. I think that his trajectory would have had to be straight up after he got back in order for him to win.
Well, and you're right. From a narrative standpoint, the fact that they continued to win, even when he was sidelined. And then if we're talking about Aaron Rodgers as a prime competitor for this spot, then the fact that they looked the way that they did in the game that he missed, it helps his narrative. It helps his leverage in the offseason. It helps all of it in a way that makes me roll my eyes really, really strongly, because I just sort of wanted it to go the other way. I thought that that was a lot more interesting if Jordan Love had come out and just totally balled out. And so we were in a position where it was like, oh, what are they going to do? Now it feels like they're backed into a corner and Aaron Rodgers will be smug and happy and it's no fun. And that's not to say I don't like Aaron Rodgers, but like there's a smugness to Aaron Rodgers. And in this set of circumstances, I don't know that I wanted it to play out that way.
I totally understand that. But it's he can kind of sit in his self-satisfaction with this. Can you imagine if he wins it again? Could you imagine if after all of
this... And then goes... Oh, we said we were done, right? I'm going to go to Denver.
If after all of this, if after this entire year and what it's looked like and just kind of the proof of concept of the way they've built this team and how good it is in certain areas, and then he comes back and he wins it again. I just cannot imagine that wrench being dropped into this. It seemed so far off and such a remote possibility, even like 6 weeks ago.
Yep.
And now we're sitting here and he's the betting favorite to win the MVP. It's wild. Like it was never on the table for me after everything that had happened. And now that it is, thinking about the domino effect and now like the ripples of what it might cause over the next year, I understand that it's kind of annoying, but it's also kind of intriguing. It cuts both ways to me.
I could totally see him taking his ball and going home after all of this very happily. Like I told you I was going to do this. We said Last Dance. That's what I meant.
This is a dangerous road we're going down here, but getting into his thought process and kind of why he wants to do this and what he's trying to get out of this. And it really does feel like he loves his guys. And mm-hmm. I think that the relationship he has with Davante Adams and the relationship he has with guys like David Bakhtiari, like there is a closeness there. And I think that them maybe winning a Super Bowl or getting to try to do it again, I'm sure that's part of the conversation and part of his consideration. But if he wins it again, I think I would love to know, all right, what am I trying to get out of this now? Like, where do I want to go? Why do I want to go there? It's not dissimilar to the Brady stuff. Like after what happened in New England, it's like, what do you want to do? And with Brady, I can totally understand. I want to show I can win again somewhere else. And then he did it. And then this year, it's kind of, I want to show that I'm like truly the best player in the league still. And if he won MVP and they won the Super Bowl again, what would he do? To me, it's always a fascinating question with these guys who their legacies are totally secure, right? Like there is nothing more in a lot of ways that they could accomplish. I think one more Super Bowl for Rodgers would probably mean more than one more MVP for Rodgers in the grand scheme of things. But if he gets both, what does that mean? Does he feel more comfortable leaving? Does he feel less? I mean, it's going to make the spring a pretty ripe time for all of us.
Where were you? If you were Rodgers, which situation would you like to go to most if you got, you know, to pick your team, as he inevitably will?
It feels like a lot of the ones that are going to be on the table are kind of in flux, right? Like Denver to me is a fascinating conversation because I like a lot of the pieces they have in place in terms of their personnel. Like their defense has guys on it. Their offense is really well positioned. They obviously re-signed Tim Patrick and Sutton. They still have Jerry Jeudy. KJ Hamler will be back next year. They have Noah Fant. They have the running backs. Their line is a pretty good unit. But then it's one of those questions. is Mike Munchak there next year? Is Vic Fangio there next year? If Vic Fangio is the head coach, do you think Aaron Rodgers wants to go play for Pat Shurmur? Is that exciting even with the players? Would they want to move on from that staff to make it maybe a more attractive destination for a veteran quarterback? Can you do that if you somehow win more than half of your games and are in the playoff conversation? And then a team like, who are some other kind of considerations? Like the Giants probably might be looking for a quarterback. Washington might be looking for a quarterback.
No chance he goes to the Giants.
I don't think so either.
Or Washington. Just because the franchise and the way it's been run, I think that that's a really tricky proposition. What about the Steelers?
The Steelers are another one, right? So like, I think that's the other one where it's, there's been success. You can talk yourself into it. But would he want to go someplace where Ben Roethlisberger just left? And then if you look at it in terms of the help he'd have there, they don't have the guys. Their offensive line is really young. It's unproven. What are they going to do with their offensive staff? Like, that's another huge question.
But they do have the wide receivers.
They do.
And they have their young running back. And they have the young tight end. And they have TJ Watt on the other side. And Minka. Like, they have pieces there that I think that they could turn things around really quickly as long as they used a ton of offseason resources in the O-line, which they should have done last year. But since they didn't do it last year, all the offseason resources, well, I guess the ones that aren't going toward bringing in Aaron Rodgers. So whatever you have left, offensive line.
It's a fascinating kind of thing with the Steelers because they are at a place where they rarely are. The pivot point available to them, they never have. Because with Roethlisberger for the last 5-6 years, they needed to find cap space in the couch cushions. And now they have all this money and very few guys that they're really tied to. I think if you look at their offensive spending next year against the cap, it's 31st in the NFL. Only the Jaguars are spending less on their 2022 offense than the Steelers are. And that's just a level of flexibility and a blank slate that they've never had over the last 15 years. So what do they do? Do they retool the staff under Tomlin? Does he feel like that's necessary? There's so much on the table for them. The other one that I think is really interesting. Like, what if the Browns, like, all right, here we went out and we got Chris Godwin, for example, whoever the free agent receiver is that they'd want, because the Browns have some money next year, right?
Yeah.
They could probably trade Baker Mayfield. His contract, the base salary of it, is definitely dealable for a team that just needs an answer short term. My thing with the Browns has always been, you move on from Baker if there's a better alternative there for you. If you can have somebody who's like, this guy's better than Baker, let's go get him, then you do it. If not, then I think you stick with him. But Aaron Rodgers is one of those guys. So I'm just wondering who the quiet teams are, like who the secret teams are that are going to be in on this quarterback market that we're not thinking about right now.
You've sold me. You've sold me on the Browns because of what you said about, like, does he want to go follow Ben Roethlisberger? Just from a, like, you're just the next guy. You know, in terms of it being your next stop, you're not doing anything that no one's done before. Pittsburgh's been good. Pittsburgh has this guy who's, you know, going to the Hall of Fame, and now you're following him and you just kind of keep it going. Whereas Cleveland has been a dumpster fire for decades. And if you can go into a roster that is completely set up to be competitive and be the guy that makes them that, this plays to like all of the things that I think Aaron Rodgers wants in his life.
I'm wondering just schematically what it would look like there, because they have a rigidity with the way that they play, right? There is that aspect of, this is the system. We're going to run the ball. We're going to use a lot of play action. And
13.
We had that kind of tension with Rodgers and LaFleur at the beginning. How much control do I have? How much autonomy do I have? What sort of signature can I put on the way the offense looks? They have found an amazing balance. Like, his ability to kind of use RPOs and, again, control what the offense feels like in a lot of situations, 2-minute, those sort of things, is great. Like, they've struck the balance that works. What would that look like in Cleveland? You know, they don't give Baker a lot of control. You'd have to give Rodgers that control. Would they be willing to surrender to somebody like him? The way that that interplay would look like with him and Stefanski, I would want to watch it. I'd want to see what that was like.
Well, yeah. Oh, I this is a very, very attractive option, I think, for Aaron Rodgers. I think that this would be very, very attractive. And also, it's so under the radar and it's not the one that everyone's talking about. And I think that that could be particularly appealing.
Last other thing with that, Alex Van Pelt is their offensive coordinator. who was his quarterback's coach for years and who he was furious when they fired him. I just remembered this. So that is another thing to maybe consider there. There's not a lot of things to worry about. Like it's not a lot of imagination about what that dynamic would look like. He knows.
And by the way, they would not have a hard time unloading Baker. Unloading is kind of an unkind word, but like, you know, but dealing him in some way, shape or form, because there are so many teams that need quarterbacks. And while Baker, I think, has proven that he might be an average quarterback and not a good quarterback, like we're sort of hovering around the middle of the pack with him. I think that there are enough teams that are going to be in need of something that would be appealing for him. Would you rather, if you were a team looking for a quarterback, would you rather have Jimmy Garoppolo brought in or Baker Mayfield or neither or start over, go rookie?
So the Baker thing, it'd probably be cheaper, right? Because I think Garoppolo's base salary is like $25 million. Baker's is less than that. It's not a huge difference, but just something to take into account. Garoppolo might be less in terms of draft capital because he's a little bit older. So that would be something to think about. It's so hard for me to imagine what Jimmy Garoppolo would look like in a normal NFL offense. And I say that with affection for what the Niners offense is, because I think it's a magnificent machine and what they've built there, but it's hyper-specific. Like it is unlike anything else in the league and how it operates. So I almost don't know. Like I don't know what Jimmy Garoppolo would look like if you played him in a system that was more traditional, that put more on him. The Niners take so much off his plate in a way that makes sense. And if a team was just, you know, you were going to play you like a traditional quarterback, sink or swim, I honestly don't know what it would look like. I think my answer is Baker, because I just appreciate, even though sometimes it's to his own detriment, I appreciate the ambition he plays with, like the aggressiveness and his willingness to push the ball a little bit in a way that Garoppolo just doesn't have. But that's also kind of the structure of the offense. It's very hard. I would put them in the same family of quarterbacks. Like we're looking at that tier that exists of Cousins, Baker, Garoppolo, Tannehill. It's all different gradations of the same idea. So I would put them in the same family of guys, I guess is what I would say.
Is that average or above average? Like what is that tier? How would you label it?
I would call it you can win with him.
Okay.
That's what I would call it, because that's when I talk to people at other places. Like when I've talked to people in Cleveland about Baker, when I talk to people in Indy about Carson Wentz, that's what they say. It's always the response is, well, we can win with him. And so that's the tier that's what I would call it just overall. Like we can win with this guy. And I think that is a backhanded compliment when people say that. I don't think anyone is excited about the quarterback they're talking about when right. That is their answer.
But at least they're not awful. And at least you can't not win with them. So. Yeah, you. I'm going to take Cousins and put him at like, he's like the king of that group at the very least. I want to put him a step above that group.
Do you think Tannehill, you think he's better than Tannehill?
I think I do.
I could understand it either way. That's what I'm saying. They're all kind of, it all shifts all the time. You know, those charts, like the Steph Curry chart, the live kind of version of who leads the career list of three pointers made. And it moves over time, like that bar graph, and guys are moving up and down and up and down. That's how I feel about that group of quarterbacks, is every single year they kind of shuffle and it doesn't really matter. You can just spin the wheel and figure out what the actual hierarchy looks like at any given moment.
So the other quarterback that I think is going to be interesting to track this season is, and this was like my big pat myself on the back yesterday moment, was the fact that Tyler Huntley came out and played as well as he did, because I all week long was like, I don't know if I'm seeing a massive drop off here from Lamar, based on the way Lamar has played in the last few weeks, to what we've seen from Tyler Huntley when Tyler Huntley has gone in Lamar's stead. Like if you just kind of watched it and like blurred your eyes a little bit, you're like, it's Lamar out there. He looks exactly the same. He does so many of the same things, which is not, you know, I know that there are things that Lamar is bringing to the table that Tyler Huntley is not bringing to the table yet. But there are so many raw skills there and things that he can do that I think that he has proven a lot to a lot of people. And considering the dearth of quarterbacks and the number of quarterback needy teams that are out there, the fact that he's on a 1-year deal with Baltimore and can go somewhere else next year, I think he's an interesting guy to just put on our offseason radar and wonder if he doesn't end up somewhere in a competition situation, maybe like go out in training camp and try and compete for this job, and or somebody that is given a type of opportunity like a Jalen Hurts, you know, like, hey, we'll bring you in and we're going to see what you can do.
It's always a question to me of what teams are trying to do with their quarterback room, right? Because I think in some situations, the Chargers to me are a perfect example. They had Justin Herbert, and this offseason they thought, we want a guy. The way I've described it, it's like a Rosetta Stone for the offense that you're running. Chase Daniel is fluent in what the Chargers offense is because of the time he spent in New Orleans with Joe Lombardi. And even talking to people there, having Chase be somebody who can tell Justin Herbert, you know, when you want something, when you're uncomfortable with something or when you're comfortable with something, this is how you should present it to Joe. Like, this is how your dialogue should look like. Having that is really valuable when you're trying to bring along a young quarterback. But if you're not, and you just want to build the best, kind of most volatile in a good way quarterback room you can, should your backup look like a guy that plays like Tyler Huntley? So that's always the question to me is, what do you want that room to look like? Are you cultivating a young guy? Are you looking just for an answer? And it's hard to know. It's hard to know what teams want out of that 2 or 3 person group that they have there.
But why are we automatically putting him as a backup quarterback?
Oh, I don't know. I think you would you feel comfortable having him be the unquestioned starter somewhere?
No, no. I think, and yes. So I get that's right. So you have to have a conversation about what it looks like if he doesn't win the starting job in training camp or whatever. And then you're right. You have to put him in a room where you can kind of go both ways. I do think that you don't necessarily want to have like a Justin Herbert and then his backup is Tyler Huntley. That doesn't totally make sense to me. I think the way that Baltimore has it built this year is brilliant. The fact that you have the backup quarterback, like, is a version of exactly what Lamar Jackson does. I think that that's brilliant. And it's one of the many, many things that front office and franchise have done that are brilliant in terms of running the team in the last number of years. And there's so many examples that we could point to, but I do think that Tyler, and he's a young quarterback, right? Like, so just because we didn't hit on him in the draft, just because he wasn't evaluated as like, this guy's a starter in the league. We've seen so many instances of guys for whom that was the case. And then they turn out to be longtime starters in the league. So I'm just saying, I guess, that the fact that he has come into big games with the circumstances being what they are, and he has played well. I think he has played well enough to get a look, you know? And so I don't necessarily think I want to relegate him to a backup quarterback position. And in a year when he's going to be on the market and so many teams need quarterbacks, I think he's an interesting guy to bring in and potentially try out to be a starter in the league. Because if he plays like he did last night and like he has played in the past games when he came in, I think that that's at least interesting. You know, we've talked about guys who create and can do it both ways, and how if you're a team that doesn't have a ton of other stuff going on, that just gives you options as an offense. And so I think it's interesting.
Jalen Hurts is a good name to mention, because I think that kind of guy, and it's like, all right, we have a team that we're kind of in evaluation mode, and that's what the Eagles were in this year. It's like, we're in evaluation mode. He's an interesting quarterback to bring in those sort of spots. And the other two teams that would come to mind, because in my mind, it's like, all right, who this offseason would have been looking for a Tyler Huntley type? And if you look at Houston and the Lions, those are two examples of teams that we're rebuilding anyway, right? Like, should we try to bring in a guy that's exciting and that maybe we can win some games with? It's good enough for us to evaluate the rest of our players. But I feel like the flip side of that is that the Lions wanted a Jared Goff because they knew what they were getting in Jared Goff. He's a veteran. He's been around. I don't know if that's worth $30 million. But I feel like they saw him as a stabilizing force in a way that somebody like Tyler Huntley, who has a year in the league, has not been around for very long, is not. I think Tyrod Taylor was the same consideration, right? They bring in Tyrod Taylor because it's a guy who's been there forever. He's been around. He's respected. We can have him be this kind of beacon in the middle of the locker room as somebody who knows the way it's supposed to be done. So is there value in bringing in a Tyler Huntley where you don't know what it is? Definitely. But I think with a rebuilding team, sometimes the way you think about the construction of the locker room, you want that veteran who's been around, even if you're not going to win a lot of games, because you're trying to build culture, however we might describe or define that. So it's interesting. It's just that there aren't a lot of opportunities for guys like Tyler Huntley, even though there should probably be more.
You mentioned Jared Goff and the Detroit Lions, and that win yesterday was so crazy because it was never in doubt. And I'll tell you what, the first, when they did an onside kick after their first offensive possession, and they didn't get it, and they handed the ball to the Cardinals with very good field position. And then the Cardinals went three and out. But either way, the fact that they went onside kick that early in the game, I was like, this is so notable because they're playing them the exact same way that they played the Rams. Just aggressive. We can't compete with them straight up. We're going to try and steal possessions. We're going to go. And the fact that it worked this time, and they controlled that game from start to finish, I think it raises questions about the Cardinals, but I'm less interested in talking about that right now as I am about what is happening in Detroit, because this has been one of my favorite teams of the year, which is the weirdest thing to say, because they're clearly one of the worst teams in the NFL. But I have felt so conflicted about Dan Campbell, because in so many ways, I really think that he is the perfect guy for this job. There are coaching management decisions that he has made that are glaringly bad. And I just think he almost needs like a coach in the offseason, like to hire exactly the right guy that's really good at all of those things and take him to school and be in his ear and be the guy on the sideline or up in the booth or whatever it is. But I just, the fact that they're playing so hard for him, the fact that he, I feel like he's turning things around there and changing the culture from within. And I think that the fact that they brought in Josh Reynolds has changed things for the offense dramatically. And it's so crazy to think that this castaway guy is that guy. But when he comes in, it opens up things for Amon-Ra St. Brown, where Amon-Ra St. Brown is looking like exactly what they wanted him to be when they drafted him all of a sudden. And then he opens things up for Josh Reynolds, and all of a sudden things click.
It's so funny that a guy who the Titans didn't want, where they have no receivers, has done this for the Lions. But that's the state of the Lions roster, right? If you look at their defense, and I look at like the ROAD's depth chart, and every single guy is like FF or SF21 or like CF21. They're all street free agents. They're all guys who are just clinging to the back end of an NFL roster. And that makes sense. They're a rebuilding team. But to get guys of that ilk playing the way that they are is so impressive to me. They're moving in one direction. And if this was just a situation where, oh, they're playing so hard, like they're playing so hard, they're giving so much effort, that would be impressive to me in its own right when they're a two-win team at this stage of the season. But when you go back and watch, we had a long conversation about this on last night's show. They do good stuff. Like they are well coached. There are aspects of their offense where you look at just the ideas and how it plays out. It's like, oh, that's a really nice play. Like that's a sound play. It makes sense when you look at the overall structure of what they do. And they've had a lot of that recently. The Vikings game was another example where they have some pass concepts, especially like in the high red zone. The throw to Josh Reynolds, like, that's really nice. Like the timing of that looks good. Their spacing in a lot of these plays is very well done. It's like the exact opposite of watching the Jaguars. And then if you look at their defense, there were a couple plays. The pass breakup on the Antoine Wesley 4th-and-2 yesterday, they passed that off beautifully. It was just a perfect little instance of two guys whose names I cannot remember. It was Parker and Davis or something. And the cornerbacks wearing number 42, like that kind of stuff. But they're doing the right things. So it's this synchronicity of effort and really sound coaching that makes you excited about it. Because if it was this rah-rah thing and you just had guys that were, you know, physical and playing hard and all that, that'd be one thing. But I have a lot of faith in the coaching staff they've built there in a more granular way. And when I was looking at the Lions this offseason and thinking about why you would be excited about them, it wasn't Dan Campbell really for me. It was the other guys they had built there. Like Aaron Glenn, to me, had always deserved a chance to be a defensive coordinator when you look at the job they'd done in New Orleans. And you clearly see it working, it taking hold, what he's doing. Aubrey Pleasant was the cornerbacks coach for the Rams, and you look at what they've done over the last few years. Now he's their passing game coordinator, and they've got college free agents galore in that secondary. You know, Jerry Jacobs was playing so well for them before he got hurt. It's guys like that. And when you have that type of staff where you can see those tangible results from players like that, it's hard not to get excited about it. And I think that we've seen plenty of examples over the years of staffs that can take you the first couple steps, but can't take you the last couple steps. And I have no idea what their talent accrual process will look like under Brad Holmes. I have no idea what the move from basic competency to pretty good NFL team will ultimately look like. But this stage, I think you have to be excited about the way it's worked out. Watching them yesterday, I had this like warm, fuzzy feeling as a football fan. It's like, this is what it's supposed to look like for you at this stage. I like this.
They are the underdog that you root for. And there are reasons that I think like a casual NFL fan might not even be able to put their finger on. Like, why am I rooting for them as opposed to some other dumpster fire, which I am just throwing my remote at the TV? I feel like you find yourself rooting for the Lions for all of the reasons that you just articulated. Who do you not feel is nailing basic competency?
The Jags are the number one example, right? I mean, there was a play that the Lions had at one point in the game. There was like a trips play on third down and they hit St. Brown on it. And just the way that it unfolded, the routes and the distribution and the timing, I was like, that's beautiful, like truly poetry. And then you watch the Jags receivers run into each other. I mean, their level of detail has been abhorrent for most of the season. And that to me is the biggest issue. It's not only is this a bad team, this is a dysfunctional team,
right?
In both the personalities and what the on-field product looks like. They're the best example. And then it's tough to put a finger on what the Jets want to be. Like when you watch them yesterday, especially, I think Zach Wilson's been really bad. Like his lack of comfort in the pocket and just how loud his feet are and just the overall, I mean, the plays he made against the Saints where he's just dirting balls that should be layups, it's concerning. But then their personnel is really lacking right now. And their offensive line, the injuries they have there, the fact that the receivers are dinged up, it's kind of hard to judge him. But I think if you look at that and a situation like the Bears, like there are a lot of bad scenarios right now. And the Lions just, in my mind, decidedly are not one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. From a win-loss record, they're in that category. But they're building something that feels like there's optimism there, whereas the Jets don't feel like they're going anywhere. And the Texans feel like they're not even in the same league, but that's a different category. The Jets and Zach Wilson, I don't know how deep into the weeds you get during draft season. And if you do any evaluation yourself or talk to people who are doing it, the thing that I keep wondering about with Zach Wilson is that all of these people that watch so much tape, the Daniel Jeremiah's of the world, the guys like that, that they all seemed to agree that they thought that he was going to be good at this level. And so I'm trying to come to terms with why, what they saw and why it hasn't panned out.
When you look at him in college, and I watch, you know, we do like positional breakdowns, but we'll do like, all right, who's your top five quarterbacks heading into the draft? We've only had one offseason on the podcast, but we did that last year. And I went back and I watched like 3 to 4 games of every single guy and try to get your hands on the all 22 and do it the right way, whatever. And when you watch Zach Wilson, I understand the appeal because we've kind of come to this place of NFL quarterbacking where having a playmaking quarterback, having someone who can play outside of structure, who can make those wow throws, we've seen the tangible benefits of having one of those guys. In his movements and how similar they are to a guy like Aaron Rodgers, I can understand kind of getting intoxicated by that. But when you watch those games he was playing at BYU, there's no one around him. I mean, it's a fortress that he's playing in. And some of those 50-50 balls that he would be able to throw to a very good receiving core, I mean, they were so much better than the teams they played against. And that to me, when you watch Joe Burrow play in college, Joe Burrow's superpower was his ability to navigate the pocket in subtle ways and his understanding of, all right, this is a slide I need to make this way. This is a small step here, a small step there. Extending plays, but extending plays in a loud, muddy area. That to me is a translatable skill. Like I would bet on that going from one level to the next. But when your superpower is purely the way you throw the football and the circumstances that you've done it in maybe aren't as translatable and it's hard to understand exactly what it will look like when the game gets uglier, that was my concern with him. There were probably 2 or 3 games that I watched where I never saw him one time step up in the pocket because he didn't have to. There was no need to step up in the pocket because there's no one around him. And when you don't see that kind of stuff and there's really no examples of it, it's hard to know what it's going to look like. And I think as the game has gotten much, much, much murkier for him and the picture is less clear, we've seen him struggle. And that's not necessarily surprising to me.
Robert, we just talked for 50 minutes and did not use the word analytics once. and so I think that we're going to notch this one up as a win. Although I got to tell you, yesterday is the first day that I really wanted to wade into those fights on Twitter. Because for the most part, I'm like, you guys just fight this one out. My left brain stopped developing in fifth grade. So I'm not the person to have analytics conversations, but I was fired up about that. The Ravens stuff. I don't know how where do you stand on all of that? I said like, oh, yay, it's a win. We didn't talk about analytics. And then I'm like, I got to ask a question.
I just don't understand why people get so worked up about it either way. I just don't understand why people seem to gleefully watch fourth downs fail. It's like, I can't believe you didn't take the points.
Yes.
All I want is for you to be able to clearly articulate why you're making those decisions and what benefits you think they have. The math has shown us that you get a small edge from being a little bit more aggressive in most situations. I know for a fact that the Chargers have pored over this stuff. They have thought about it from every single possible angle. The math is being applied to the decisions that he's making in those moments. I also know that this is all situational. If you're Brandon Staley and you're playing against that Chiefs team and you think, you know, their offense has not been a machine this year. We don't necessarily need to push it into the red the way that you would have 2 or 3 years ago. We don't need to score 35 to win. This is the first drive of the game. It's 4th and 5. Let's take the points here. Let's, you know, have it be a positive drive. Let's keep the game going. I would understand that. If you think the math tells us right now that we have a better chance of winning this game if we score a touchdown here, it's still Patrick Mahomes. They still have that gear to them. We might need 30 in this game. How many more times against a defense that's been really good this year are we going to be at the 5-yard line with a chance to score a touchdown? Are we only going to have this many drives in this game? I just feel like there are probably decent answers on both sides. So for people to really delight in just crapping on one side or the other in these moments just makes no sense to me.
Well, I just don't, I feel like people who really desperately want the math to be wrong because it's not what they grew up thinking about football. Like in this situation, we've always done this. So we should continue to always do this. I'm like, when you go to Vegas, are you not interested in probabilities? When you look at the lines, are you not interested in the lines? Are you not doing any research outside of that? Like, what do you think goes into that? That's all math. That's all probabilities. So in some cases, you absolutely want all the information that you can get before you're going to make your decision. But in this case, you're like, gut. It's my gut. I want my gut to. And by the way, like the Ravens' decision to go for two was gut, right? Like it was gut. It was our defense isn't playing as well as we would like our defense to play. And I'm not sure we can stop Aaron Rodgers. And I'm not sure we should go to overtime against Aaron Rodgers, where we have a coin flip that decides whether or not we may never touch the ball. Aaron Rodgers, do you think he's not going to drive down the field? Like everyone's seen that before. Everyone would know, like, this is exactly how this is going to end. It doesn't mean it will end that way, but like, that's the expectation. So to me, the only thing that my math brain can compute, because I will never make the argument about you should go for two or you shouldn't. Like I'll leave that up to mathematical experts. What I feel comfortable articulating is that if you are going to go for two and he decides I want to play for a regulation win, again, kind of a gut call, then you have to go for two the first time that you score to cut the lead to 8. So when he didn't do that and he kicked, that was so anti what he has always done. It's so inconsistent with the way that he approaches situations. John Harbaugh literally stood at the podium after last week's game and he articulated exactly why you would go for two that first time. And so when he kicked, I was like, that's super weird. Maybe he's playing for overtime. So when he lined up the second time, like he was going to go for two after that last touchdown, I thought he's just trying to draw them off sides. There's no way he's going to go for two because he, of all coaches, would have gone for two the first time. Because it's a probabilities thing. And that part makes sense to me. If you're going to go for two and you've decided we're trying to win, we are not trying to tie. we are trying to win in regulation, not to send this game to overtime, then you have to give yourself two chances to get the 2-point conversion. Why would you give yourself one chance? Why would you narrow your probability window? If you go the first time, then you have three scenarios, three pathways that are open to you. You either are going to win in regulation, you're going to tie and send it to overtime, or you're going to lose, but you have three. If you go for two just on the last try, then you're either going to win in regulation or you're going to lose. There is no other pathway available to you. I don't understand why that is hard to understand for people who are like, no, he should have just gone for two the second time. I don't understand the whole math for the argument for the first, and or just shouldn't have gone for two at any point.
I haven't heard the answer as to why he didn't, but that's absolutely right. I mean, they should have gone for two the first time, and they would be the team that you would assume did. You're kind of in the moment. I don't know how that happens. I would love to hear his answer on that, because that's exactly right. I mean, that's, you would assume that team and the way that they make decisions, that it would be an automatic thing for them to go for two in that moment, and they didn't.
I don't know if he was asked after the game, because I went looking for it and I couldn't find a clip of him explaining that, because that's what I wanted to know. I wanted someone to ask, if you were going to go for two, why didn't you go for it the first time? Especially after that big probability answer that he gave last week. Like, he just laid it all out for you, and then he was inconsistent with his thought process this time. But this is, I think, where the fight with analytics and traditional football, and there doesn't have to be this fight. Like, I don't know why the two can't coexist. It's just extra information at your disposal. And I think that that's where it comes into play. Like, there are so many people that are like, I don't want to know that information. That's nerdy math. This is real man football. And so I think that there are so many people that just turn their brains off when those conversations happen and don't make any effort to really understand the thought process behind the quote unquote analytics. And by the way, I think that that's a word that's turning into like media. Like, yeah. The media, like, who's the media? Like, we're all working together. Are you joking? We're so different. Everybody in the media is so different, with different agendas, non-agendas, whatever. Analytics has become like this one word, this catch-all. And it's not that. It's just information, for crying out loud. You're against information. It makes no sense to me.
But it doesn't.
I don't think anyone asked the question. But my point is, I think that that's a conversation that, like, we need to have people on these the network football shows. We need to have people on the broadcasts that are getting coached up in these situations so that then they can articulate to the viewer, this is why, not just analytics says, I don't know if I would do it. That drives me nuts, because it doesn't teach the viewer anything. And if all of the teams are operating with all this information, it's changing the way they're making decisions, then we as a media unit, we owe it to the viewer to provide them with the information about why they're doing this and how it will impact the games that they're watching, so that they can understand.
It makes no sense that we have rules experts, but we don't have analytics experts.
Yes.
And if you're going to have just a more well-rounded understanding of it, I absolutely think that is a really good idea. To me, this has always been, I had a friend who worked in a front office of a basketball team for years, and he ran their analytics department, an NBA team. And we talked about, this was a decade ago, you know, when the Michael Lewis, Shane Battier story was in the New York Times. I mean, there was at the kind of the fledgling era of the NBA analytics movement. And we always talked about the difficulties with this taking hold being a communication thing. It was a gap in communication more than it was anything else. And I feel like the teams that get the most out of this have done a great job of understanding that. Like, if you look at the Browns, for example, Andrew Berry went to Harvard, but Andrew Berry is like a ripped former football player who was a lifetime scout. Like, that guy is a perfect messenger for these ideas. Kevin Stefanski, who wholeheartedly believes in this stuff, he is a perfect messenger and kind of harbinger for these ideas, because he's a football guy. He's a run the ball guy. And I think that understanding that, the fact that the Colts are so adhere to these sorts of ideas, and that they have guys like John Park in their front office, and they have a constant dialogue with Frank Reich, because Chris Ballard is a true blue scout. Like, that is what he's always done. The fact that he's open to these things, that it's always a reminder to me that that is the question at hand. How well can you communicate these ideas to both the people in your building and to the people outside of your building, because I think that if more of us, if more teams, if more everyone took that into account when we were having this discussion, we would save half the time that we have arguing about all this stuff.
Football Twitter would look so different.
God, I pray for the day.
Robert, I really appreciate your time. Have a great holiday.
Awesome. I really appreciate you having me.
Great stuff from Robert. Really enjoyed that conversation. I hope that you did also. If you did and you want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcasts. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Special thanks to SiriusXM's Senior Vice President of Sports Programming and Podcasting, Steve Cohen. And we'll be back on Wednesday with more. I hope you'll join us then.
SiriusXM Podcasts.